It was back in 1914 that I first met Frank, when he came to work at Union Settlement as a social worker. He was just back from 2 years in China as a missionary after graduation from Princeton in 1911, where, as the New York Times reported the other day, he was a retired architect and a wrestling champion. Actually, he was one of the first Princetonians to win the intercollegiate heavyweight championship, although he had few of the characteristics normally associated with professional wrestlers. Union Settlement, which had been founded by my father, Galen White, and of which he was then the head worker, was where the White family lived, that is to say, East Harlem in New York. As I came to know and look up to Mr. Wells, I was then at the tender age of 13, and I had made his acquaintance before my sister, I decided he would fit very nicely into the White family, and in the subtle fashion of a young teenager, I began to promote the idea. Whether or not this had anything to do with Frank's successful courtship of the boss's daughter, Susie, is a moot question. Our mother had died shortly before their wedding in 1917, so the Wellses lived in an adjoining apartment where Susie performed the dual function of raising her own family and mothering her kid brothers and sister, as well as acting as hostess for her father. In her inimitable way, she did a superb job in those difficult years. And of course, Frank, or Frankie, as he came to be known, aided and abetted in many chores, including carrying me up and down stairs for many weeks while recuperating from illness. Frank, in the meantime, had become assistant head worker at Union, greatly relieving my father of a heavy workload. And he was immensely popular with the young people of this crowded community. They not only looked up to him, but also had great respect for his occasional need to administer chastisement. Frank had married into a sailing family, and not having had much conditioning as a boy, he was not always quite as much at ease at sea as the rest of us. After one famous cruise on the good ship Baboon, a 55-footer, much too large for we unexperienced sailors to handle, during which we encountered many storms and squalls, the experience had so impressed itself on Frankie that for many days after returning to terra firma, Susie had to haul him back to bed after he had jumped out with the cry, "My God, we're aground again." It was about in 1923 that Frank resigned from the settlement to take up his consuming interest in architecture. And this is not for me to relate, but it simply remains to mention the acquisition of Frankie and Susie's place in the country and the planning and building of their incredible house known as Westport. The construction of this fantastic structure, which was accomplished almost entirely by slave labor, albeit willing, of many relatives and friends, was interspersed with many gay parties, not the least of which involved the transporting of materials from as far away as Lower Manhattan, and after a trip of many hours in those days, arriving in Westport to unload by the light of the moon plus a little moonshine. But I have gone beyond my era.
Really, my family, quite close to the Wells. And first, I would like to state that Frank managed to get one of his classmates in 1911 to be the first president of the Boys Athletic League, and that's 44 years ago. About 30 years after that, I encouraged him to become a board member of the Guiding Eyes for the Blind that my son is director of, and Frank there again did much work in rehabilitating their buildings and the new buildings that they constructed. And sometime in between, Frank became almost associated with both the Boys Athletic League of New York and the Girls Vacation Fund, and was the architect and planner of all of their buildings, and they have 11 camps in the country. Now I want to go back almost a half a century to 1917. I was at Union Settlement Camp, Nathan Hale at Huntington, and camping was rugged in those days. And we had some guests coming toward the end of the summer. One of the head workers, assistant heads, and that was Frank. And he came with Sophie, and I had to get out and lose my tent because they stayed there for a couple of days. And I had to go on a couple of overnight hikes with my groups. And that was 52 years ago. The next year I was from the Middle West. The next year I came back to New York, and then was at Union Settlement. And there was a war going on, as you know, and soon there was prohibition. And 50 years ago now, 1919, that great flu epidemic in New York, and we worked day and night. Social workers were not unionized or organized in those days. Union Settlement was a true social settlement. It was one of the four largest settlements in the city. And after a few years, I had something to do with two other of those settlements. But I always felt that my true love was union. And like Frank, I met my wife at Union Settlement. Now, Frank's fort was people. He liked people. He was interested in people. It didn't make any difference if it was the Chinese laundromat up the street, the Jewish shopkeepers across the street. They all talked with Frank all the time, and he always had time for them, or our Irish janitor. Union Settlement, when I came, was a little bit over its peak, and the immigration quota had been passed. Citizens from the southern countries of Europe were allotted, and few could come after then, but it was still the day of the melting pot. Union Settlement was, in those days, in South Harlem. Now they call it East Harlem. There's no South or no North. They're just East Harlem and Harlem. And our constituency was Irish and German and Jewish and Italian. So they were mostly all Catholics or Jewish. And as I've said so many, many times, and it was 99% supported by Protestants. I got to know Frank, of course, not only before 1923 when he resigned and took up a new field, and then there were a few years of gap when he came back into the picture as far as I was concerned in the things that I was doing in New York. Frank was on practically every committee that you could think of, whether for new playgrounds in New York City, the old Intersettlement Athletic Association, the Intersettlement Association, the United Neighborhood Houses. He was on all the committees. His work was not just in South Harlem. I know of no one who helped more to influence me to stay in social work. If it was anyone at all, it was Susie's father, Dr. Gaylord White, who in his library one night practically changed the whole course of my life. Instead of going west, I remained in New York, and with Clee, we each have 3 more weeks to go, and we're going to call it quits and retire. His interest was wide in the social settlement field, whether it was in athletics or recreation or the arts. He could build a set for a play, construct it, design it, paint it, and work on the costumes, and with Susie and others do the directing or dramatic production. Many, many times he would start at 6 o'clock in the evening and the play would be the next night and he'd work all night. And I just have one personal thing that I'd like to let you in on to show you how keen he felt about his fellow workers. The Harknesses in those days used to now and then leave out a few tickets for the opera. And in those days you had to have, you went in full dress, and I didn't even have a tux. I wasn't Frank's size, but I wore his full dress suit and took some young lady from the settlement to the Metropolitan Opera. And after the intermission, I turned around and there was Frank sitting back of me in his regular week-a-day clothes, and I was up front in his dress suit. I know of no social worker who's contributed more from the time that he was at Union until the time he left as an actual paid worker, or anyone who volunteered and gave of his time and was dedicated to the people of the great city of New York.
It's not possible to speak of anyone whom we love very dearly without speaking very, very personally. And to recall what that dear loved friend gave to us in particular. I knew Frank Wells only slightly in college, but apparently the influence of Woodrow Wilson was taken as seriously by him as it was by some of the rest of us who were young men in college at that time. And I remember meeting him shortly after college. He had started training for the ministry after he left Princeton and had been in China for a year. He'd come back and he'd begun working at Union Settlement. Now, not many men who practice architecture all of their lives start out to study for the ministry. But it seems to me particularly significant that Frank did this and that he felt called away from the ministry into architecture because he thought it offered to him a way to do something materially that would help the condition of his fellow men. Now, while he became an architect, and while, as I will try to tell you, he contributed a great deal to physical environment, he never forgot his fellow men. As an architect, particularly in working with his fellows, whether it was in the office or when he went out on the job, he was a man who drew his fellow men to himself and who inspired them and had their confidence, and everybody he touched, he increased their sensitivity. He increased their sensitivity of feeling, and he increased it mentally. And the result is that he got the best out of all whom he touched or came near. All the men on the job loved him, whether they were a so-called common laborer, or whether they were a skilled mechanic, or whether they were a consulting engineer, or even whether they were a client. And never a client disagreed with him, except when Frank took the point of view of the workman who had done his job well and done it according to the directions that he had. He came to the office that I had started from the Open Stair Dwellings, which was a group that was trying to do better design in what were then called tenement houses. And he worked consistently for better housing. He showed a great imaginative talent. Frank was the man who could look at your drawing or look at the scheme on which you were working and tell you, frankly, it isn't good enough. You've got to work some more on it. And then slowly, partly because of his love for you, you would find that he was helping you to shape something that would make you do it better than you thought you possibly could. I think the mechanical drawing part of it irked him, but he was wonderful at freehand drawing and at his sketches. And later on, he developed this, when he had more time, to the work that he did in painting. His imagination carried him along so that he could take the thoughts of the past or the thoughts of another civilization and bring it out and interpret it for today's life. One of the houses that he did in the latter part of his life, the Japanese house for Mr. Abbott, is a case in point. Now, I think when a man has the ability to increase the sensibility of his fellows and of his friends, and to make all the men he works with his friends, there is nothing that could be a finer thing that he can contribute. And when you speak of architecture and think of Frank Wells, you don't speak of something that is cut and dried. You speak of the human people who need shelter and who find it a delight to make their shelter more human.
Cannot wither nor custom stale his infinite variety is a Shakespearean line applicable to him. He was a many-sided man. His insatiable curiosity took him along amazing highways and byways. He was an extraordinary architect, as well as an artist in landscaping. He dabbled in many sciences. The diversity of his interests were truly remarkable. He had real Yankee ingenuity. He invented numerous ingenious mechanical gadgets. He forged for himself an ethic peculiarly his own. He was a warm-blooded, sensitive, breathing human being. You will all assume, of course, that I was talking about Franklin C. Wells, and of course, in a sense, I am. But actually, these words I have taken verbatim from the presses of Nathan Schachner's biography of Thomas Jefferson. To me, Frankie Wells was in a good many little ways cast in a mold similar to that of Thomas Jefferson. After taking his AB degree in Princeton, in 1911, his social-mindedness and social conscience led him to the Far East, where he spent 2 years, 1911 to 1913, in the Princeton University YMCA project, during the time that the Empress Dowager was deposed and the Chinese Republic established. He supervised the international legation guards and organized entertainment and athletic events for them and for the American troops there. He had been an athlete in college, and as already been stated, he was Princeton's first heavyweight intercollegiate wrestling champion, for which he got a medal and also earned his varsity P, of which he was immensely proud. His love for his alma mater was lifelong. He was a real Princetonian. He was largely responsible for the establishment of the Princeton class of 1911 house at 2 Dickinson Street, designed the tap room for it, and the whole idea was so successful that other Princeton classes copied it. When he returned to the United States, he first did some settlement work on the Upper East Side, where he lived in the slums to deal with people, and came to the conclusion that too many men were paid too small wages. This led to his becoming interested in housing, which in turn led to his association with Mr. Holden, from whom you've just heard. Frankie was a superb architect. His architectural bent was because of his birth in the Near East and his protracted stay in Peking, derived from the Orient, from the Chinese and especially the Japanese, rather than the Italian Palladio, which inspired Mr. Jefferson. In addition to low-cost housing, Frankie designed and supervised the construction of the home of many of his friends. He was not only an architect, but a designer and an interior decorator. He could change the feeling of an entire room by just redesigning the fireplace or changing the ceiling molding. I had the good fortune at one time working with him on a composite set of bookcases, woodwork to frame a fireplace, and molding to cover an entire wall in the home of a mutual friend, which he cut in my cellar and then transported in a station wagon for assembly on location, and it all fitted. He was unusually adept at the drawing board, and with hands and with his tools. He had a great respect and love for tools and their uses. He was a stage designer for fun. He had an unusual capacity for creating theatrical illusions with very simple gadgets, which he invented as the need arose on the spur of the moment. He was a natural-born gadgeteer, as was Mr. Jefferson, who was America's first gadgeteer. He always tried to make do with the materials at hand, to which Fred Squire here can attest. The crowning piece of interior design, I'm proud to say, is in my cellar. He was given the assignment of converting Betsy's Rumpus Room into a setting to display some of the curios and objets d'art which I had picked up around the world, and at the same time to provide facilities to house about 3,000 volumes of books without looking like a library. The kura in my cellar is the result, the kura being the word he himself selected, taken from the Japanese, as that room in your abode which was built to house your most favorite possessions. The kura is laid out like a room in a geisha house, and he improvised and amended the original concept as he went along, much to the disgust of the Norwegian carpenter, who threw up his hands and said that the man is impossible to work with. He's gone Japanesey. He was a perfectionist in trying to achieve effects. I had a Thai head of a Buddha, which he framed in a setting to give it the feeling of a Buddhist temple. He was never quite satisfied with the background of gold paint, which he originally planned, and eventually came up with some gold Chinese tea paper, which he cut up in squares and put in the back of this Buddha. He acquired this paper and squirreled it away years ago from a project he was on with the late Frank Lloyd Wright. As an architect and designer, he was naturally good with pencil and paintbrush. I'm sure many of you in this audience have been the recipients of his delightful Christmas cards, which were hand drawings. And in his later years, he turned more and more to drawing and painting as an outlet for his creative ability. I am proud to say I'm the possessor of the best thing he ever did in this line, namely an oil painting of a house in Charleston, South Carolina, which he did in 1944, and for which he himself found and acquired an antique Florentine frame. In quoting from Mr. Jefferson, I said he forged for himself an ethic peculiar his own. He was a kind of a socialist, and a feeling for the common man in his general outlook. And over the years, this was a subject of lively discussion between us, and I was never able to persuade him that, although ethically commendable, many of his theories were not necessarily practical. In other areas, I found myself in complete agreement with him. I think he's the first person I ever heard discuss the problem of water pollution, and this goes back at least 30 years. Frankie liked people. He had a storehouse of interesting anecdotes and reminiscences. He was always good company. He was a warm-blooded, sensitive, and breathing human being. In short, Frankie was fun to be with. and I'm sure we will always remember him that way.
Frank Wells was an inspired and a dedicated painter. His work was virile, exciting, and often dramatic. It was my privilege on several occasions to accompany Frank on painting expeditions out in the country. And it was an education in itself to hear him talk about composition, the mixing of colors, perspective, texture, the play of light and shadows, and so forth. He could see things in the landscape that few eyes could see. Upon his return from Graz, Austria, after serving there for 6 months as Montclair's ambassador of goodwill to our sister city, he was asked to exhibit the paintings that he had done in Austria in a one-man show at the Montclair Art Museum. This he did. The exhibition extended over a period of time, and it was very well attended. Later on, he submitted a painting to one of the annual New Jersey State exhibitions. And that painting was not only accepted and hung, but a distinguished jury awarded it honorable mention. I doubt if there's an organization in Montclair that at one time or another hasn't gone to Frank Wells in trouble with some artistic problem. Posters had to be made, hand lettering done, signs painted, sketches made, and I never heard of any case where he turned down any one of these requests. I see a large number of people here from the Cosmopolitan Club. Over a period of years, I wonder how that club could ever have existed without Frank Wells. He was one of their presidents. He was involved in half a dozen major activities. At one time, he had a behind-the-scenes committee of 50 men working for him on his stage sets for their productions. On one occasion, he was asked to make a set of a Persian garden. Aside from the flowers, the garden furniture, the walls, and other properties, on the stage he had an honest-to-goodness fountain with honest-to-goodness running water. And in order to complete the illusion, he scented the water with attar of roses and had the mist blown out over the audience with electric fans. He did similar work for the studio players in Montclair, and it was always his practice to make models, cardboard models of his stage sets, and then juggle the pieces around until he had exactly what he wanted. In my book, if Frank Wells had done nothing more than follow the various aspects of his art, he would have made a major contribution to the cultural life of this community.
Mrs. Wells asked me to say a few words about Frank Wells's contributions to Overseas Neighbors. As I started to think about Frank, whom I haven't known as long as many of his close friends who have spoken here today. One of his many hobbies came to my mind and revolved and came back again until I found that it would be easier to write a few stanzas about Frank than to say, speak in prose as these gentlemen have done so well. The hobby that I had in mind, that came to my mind, was water mills, which have not been mentioned particularly so far today. Frank, as you know, traveled hundreds of miles to visit brooks where mills had once been, ruins of mills, fragments of mill wheels. I never went with him, but I've heard him talk about it. As the word wheel came back to my mind, and the mill, and the dam, and the inevitable bridge, these seemed like symbols of Frank Wells's life, and here they are in about 2 minutes. I will not apologize for verse because, as you know, Frank was always charitable to amateurs, whether in stage set building, or dramatics, or folk dancing, or even in poetry. To the memory of Franklin C. Wells. The wheel of life goes on incessantly. Like a ship's wake, its track is soon erased. And round our path, like mist upon the sea, a curtain falls. Yet all is not effaced. There live a few clear moments. Memory clings to the great and good whom we've embraced in our heart's microcosm. Here, Frank Wells forever lies enshrined, forever dwells. Frank loved to build. His boundless energy was all creative. With one mind and will, he served his vision of society, shaping his world with loving care and skill that men might live secure in dignity. His prototype, the ancient rural mill, where crystal waters flowing from afar came from the heights to where the people are. From every man to every other one, there is a fearful chasm, deep and wide. The genius of the human race has won no greater prize than spanning this divide. Than Franklin Wells, no architect has done more able work, safe bridges to provide. Long may we cherish Frank's last and crowning labors as a charter member of Overseas Neighbors. Frank bridged the seas as our ambassador. He bridged the gaps of language, class, profession. He was no alien by the River Moor, but friends in mathematical progression flocked to this man of kindness to the core till he became the people's proud possession. Now many friends Frank made when he was there will come next fall to visit in Montclair, and Graz will mourn with us this heavy loss behind its crenellated mountain walls. Schloss Herberstein will lift its silver cross. There will be eulogies in Styrian halls. Under the Kepler Bridge with ancient moss, the racing moor will slow until it crawls. For Frank saw everything, and what he saw, he loved. And love is man's most sacred law.
Frank and Sue began that Christmas custom of sending out to their many friends, near and far, their Christmas broadsides. These cards were a definite and direct indication of Frank's skill, craft, artistic imagination, sense of humor, and spiritual insight. To a certain extent,
They are his own written biography. To a certain extent, they are his statement of faith, hope, and charity. And Sue thought this to be true. And you can imagine my profound and moved transport when she asked me to present to this group of dear friends the meaning and the recollection of these Christmas cards. 1928 was the first, and they ran through the years until of late, when the capacity was no more. But they remain, all those who have received them can never, never forget. And of this large collection, I've had the pleasure in the last days of conning and checking. And being a preacher, each one seemed to me a sermon in the truest sense, of profound meaning. And there are five that I would like to recall to you as conveying the symbols of the whole collection, as a reminder of his whole life. And the first is the card that came in 1948, and this is the motto. More stately mansions for humankind. And the card is a signal traffic post. First Avenue, East 143rd. Foundations, contract is let, and the light is green. The second has to do with the line that ran through most of these cards, a reference to that family of his of which he was so incredibly proud. There is no way to peace. Peace is the way. 1956, at the top is a profile of Susie and Frank. And then come four exquisite little thumbnail sketches, vignettes. The Pfeiffer's in Karachi, the capital of the United States. The Hortons in Westport, and that charming homemade home house. The Mises in Saigon. The new baby being drawn in a cart by a tiger. And the Butlers in New Haven. The new boy being drawn by a bulldog with a Y on his chest. And I'm glad to say that in this sketch, the tiger can easily devour the bulldog. The next, his beloved overseas. From Susie and Franklin Wells. Over to Grotz from Montclair town, above the tide sweeping up and down, seagulls wheel under the lee of a strong new bridge above the sea. Gray in the mist as the sea fog drips, sail under and past, the ghosts of ships, war canoes, caravels, stout Vikings, bold, Half Moon Santa Maria, ships with gold, warriors, pirates, adventurers, amazed to see this bridge above the illimitable sea.
The savage old past must go undercover. The friendship bridge will now take over, kind and beautiful in its shining grace, triumphing over time and space. And then here's this beautiful arched bridge, the sun and the stars and the moon in the background, and the many ships floating, sailing, trafficking under this big, gracious span. And then l'envoi of 50 nations compacted. Grandchildren are we, and great-grandchildren. Our grandsires sleeping over there, we do not forget. Across the friendship bridge we send praise, applause, memories, and love. And the next, 1954 this is. The quotation, is it possible that each of us who have enough food could resolve to feed and person who now lives, could resolve to feed one person who now lives in those dark areas where 2/3 of the Earth's population is slowly starving? That's the question. And then here is the world, the globe, in black, smashed in are the hungry places. In green are the abundant places. And written on each side, in very small print, what projects can we imagine? And here his imagine takes unlimited flight. Mentioned here all those things which we hear mentioned today. Having to do with the improvement of life everywhere. Utterly, utterly incredible. A vision. This in 1954. I wish this could be plastered on the lintels of the White House. I wish this could be spread abroad where all could see it in the Capitol of the United States. I wish all the Capitol buildings of the world could have this emblazoned before them, and every home in America could have it fastened to their household lintel. And at the end, these words from the Gospel of Jesus. As the day began to wear away in this desert place, he took 5 loaves and 2 fishes and gave to the multitude, so that 5,000 were fed. And I come to the last, and this is the quotation. All races and all nations shall become as one, and all men brothers. And here are 14 temples of worship from the world around, from different land, clime, and time. The different temples of mankind, all of them, wherein men meet and bow themselves in prayer and lift their hearts to God, each in his own tongue. This card he let us have, Beatrice and me, to give to our people in Cleveland as our Christmas card years ago. Our cherished reminder of my big brother. Let this be put in the chancels of our Christian churches. All races and all nations shall become as one, and all men brothers. I noticed that the daily press announced a secular memorial service this afternoon. A secular memorial service. I don't think so. Dr. Huber, I don't think so. I think we have here, by the magnificent loving tributes which have been expressed, by the words which we have read, I think we have here religion, high, broad, deep. I think we have here religion in its authentic spiritual expression. And these tributes that have been given so beautifully by these loving friends are the testament of a most kindly and generous life. And these words which have been read are no less than words of Holy Writ.
No man death diminishes me, for I am involved in mankind. Seek not therefore to know for whom the bell tolls. It tolls for thee. And in the 19th century, another towering figure, Cardinal John Henry Newman, wrote this prayer, which we shall offer together now. Let us bow our heads. O Lord, support us all the day long of this our human life, until the shadows lengthen and the evening comes and the busy world is hushed and the fever of life is over and our work is done. Then, in thy great mercy, grant us a safe lodging, a holy rest, and peace at the last, through Jesus Christ, our Lord. The grace of the Lord Jesus Christ, the love of God, and the communion of the Holy Spirit be with you all. Amen.